G'day and welcome to the Country Hour. My name's Charlie and we all want to get on with our neighbours, don't we? Because after all, sharing a fence line means you also share some common problems. But what if one side of the fence isn't doing their bit? And what if the neighbour happens to be the state government?
The worst transgressor for non-compliance with biosecurity for control of it is the government.
And we've also talked a lot already about the potential of Northern Australia. Well, now the federal government's hoping a shake-up of its guidelines for the multi-billion dollar loans facility will finally get funds flowing in the north. G'day. My name's Charlie. It's 12, well, it's 6 past 12 right now, and in a moment I will be opening up the talkback line, 1300 360 612, or you can always send me a text, 0487 993 222. I want to hear about your experiences, good or bad, of living next door to the government. I'll tell you a little bit more about that story in a moment, but first of all, there's movement at the station. For the word had passed around that the federal government's getting as edgy as you are when it comes to the lack of projects being funded through its Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility, the NAIF. Now, it's been nearly 2 years since NAIF's $5 billion loan facility was set up to turbocharge infrastructure development projects in the north. Yet, so far, only one project, a marine support base in Onslow in Western Australia, has been funded. That's to the tune of about $16 million. You know, you're going to hear very soon from the Northern Infrastructure Minister, Matt Canavan, about changes to the NAIF he hopes will crank that up a few gears. But it's clear that the Minister's acutely aware of the frustrations of proponents right across the regional landscape. Joseph O'Brien is one of them. He is looking to tap into the NAIF to develop a transmission line 900 kilometres from Mount Isa to Townsville. He told Eric Barker it's a long and expensive process to get projects ready for the NAIF.
The North Australia Infrastructure Facility is an incredibly valuable opportunity. It's one that is challenging for projects to make the most of, but for projects who are in a position to utilise NAIF, they are mature enough to utilise NAIF, it is an incredibly valuable incentive to bring forward infrastructure in Northern Australia.
One of those pieces of infrastructure Joseph O'Brien is keen to bring forward is the Copperstring project.
The Copperstring project, which many people might be familiar with over the past decade, is about as NAIF as it gets, in my opinion. It's a very large, common user, lateral piece of infrastructure across perhaps the most valuable supply chain in Northern Australia. The ability to secure capital from NAIF improves dramatically the economics of a piece of infrastructure like Copperstring. And we've been very pleased with the discussions we've had with NAIF to date and the alignment between the mandate, the government's policy objectives and our project.
Mr. O'Brien met with the NAIF board in Mount Isa yesterday, who were in town to have a roundtable discussion with potential investors in the area. Director Bill Shannon says while it is exciting to see the potential development, it's also important people manage their expectations of the facility.
If there's an issue with getting things done, it's the fact that we are there for the money to do the deal at the end of the day. In other words, all the approvals have to be in place, all the environmental impacts, the pre-feasibilities, the feasibilities, the offtake agreements, and all of those sorts of things take a long while. So one of the things that I found interesting is talking to people about managing their expectations. The money's there, we want to see it put to good use, but it's not there for feasibilities, and it's not there for all the earlier steps. They must be done, and we are literally the place you come when you're ready to get the money to make sure it happens.
While those feasibility studies and everything are happening, which for these bigger projects is very essential, but at what point should people be bringing in the NAIF just for a conversation?
Very early in the piece, we can assist in giving them the rundown on what needs to occur, and we can point them in the right direction to get those sorts of things done. There are separate government funding streams available to help that happen, but otherwise that would be the proponent would put that together. The NAIF model is a proponent-led model. That's all I hear people say, well, why doesn't NAIF do this and why doesn't NAIF do that? That's all very well, but in fact, it's not NAIF that does it. NAIF is the funder. It's the proponents that have to put these deals up.
That's Bill Shannon, former Mayor of the Cassowary Regional Council, now Director on the Board of the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund, speaking with Eric Barker after some workshops wrapped up in Mount Isa yesterday. Mr. Shannon suggesting there that it's partly about managing your expectations around the NAIF. But Minister for Northern Australia, Matt Canavan, well, he is adjusting the levers on that facility so that the community's high expectations will be met.
Well, it has been challenging, and I freely admit that we've had to make some changes here to try and get things moving. We haven't issued as many loans as we would have liked by now. The NAIF has only been running for just over a year and a half. And compared to some other infrastructure funds, both here and around the world, its progress is not lagging by any great degree. But we do have some concerns that without these changes, some of the good projects that are in the pipeline that are almost ready may not get to that final bankable, investable stage.
So you say these changes will increase the flexibility and improve the potential for support for projects in partnership with the private sector. How are they going to do that?
Well, I'll do that principally by removing what was an arbitrary threshold on the NAIF that they couldn't invest more than 50% of a project's debt. So the reason we had that there, of course, is to try and make sure that the private sector had some skin in the game and we were protecting taxpayer interest. But that's proven quite challenging to get projects across the line when you've got a hard-nosed a quantitative threshold like 50%. We're instead going to rely on the expertise and diligence of the Northern Australian Infrastructure Facilities Board. They do have a lot of background in finance, commercial activities. They need to be able to judge those risks. And just like any commercial investor or financial institutions, properly assess those risks, make sure taxpayer interests are protected, but also, of course, get projects, get business going as well.
Will that go far enough?
Well, look, there's no guarantees in life, but when things aren't going as you expected, of course, you review them and try and change them. Our objective hasn't changed. We are very committed to seeing Northern Australia develop. This is not the only thing we're doing in the north. We have successfully funded more than $700 million of projects in road and water infrastructure. We have established a cooperative research centre on Northern Australian agriculture. I'm announcing another project that it's backing, and the East Kimberley's here today. And today I know we're going to have some fruitful discussions with states and territories at a ministerial forum about future plans and future funding arrangements for infrastructure across the north.
But Minister Canavan, you must hear the frustration that I hear, that there's a lot of discussion, a lot of talking still going on about the potential of Northern Australia, but not a lot of rubber hitting the road. Some proponents in northwest Queensland who were meeting with NAIF bureaucrats yesterday spoke about feeling as though they'll never meet the threshold, particularly the requirement to have all of their investment, their private backing, locked in before they can lodge a successful application. They're suggesting that often it's the other way around. They get the government support and then the private funds will flow. How do you respond to that concern?
Look, I'm happy to talk to those people directly if you can pass on their details. Because it's not the case that the NAIF can't or don't issue so-called letters of credit, if you like. That's sort of conditional finance based obviously on many other conditions. Obviously, before money is transferred, all of the finance and from other backers has to be set in stone as well. But of course, like when you're getting a mortgage on your home, you can get conditional approval based on you doing a bunch of other things before the bank transfers the money to your account. So that can be done. It has been done. But of course, projects need to be to a level of bankability for NAIF to get on board as well.
When you announced that $1 billion loan facility, could you have envisaged that nearly 2 years later that there'd still only be one single project on the books?
Well, as I said earlier, there's not that many examples of this. It's quite an innovative way of delivering government finance. But take, for example, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which has a similar basis. It took 11 months to fund its first project. It wasn't really until it got more than 2 years that it had a large portfolio of projects invested. It didn't have some of the restrictions that were placed on the NAIF. The United States has a road infrastructure program, which is similar to the NAIF, and again, had very few projects, even 4 or 5 years after its establishment in the 1990s, but it's now very successful. It does take a long time to take projects from an idea.
Sure. I guess what I'm just trying to establish, I'm trying to establish, though, Minister, is NAIF meeting the government's own expectations, let alone the community's?
Well, as I say, we're making these changes because it hasn't met our expectations, but I'm also trying to put that in context, that it is going to take time. This was always a longer-term initiative in our white paper. We have already funded $700 million worth of roads, including building first inland link between Cairns and Melbourne, the Hand Highway, that's going ahead now. The first stage of that has been completed, including really important beef roads like the Claremont to Alpha link that's starting in the next couple of months. These things are happening now. The NAIF is always going to take some time to build momentum.
How much time, Minister? How long will it be before we're having these interviews about actual projects that are being funded?
Well, look, I'm not putting arbitrary timelines on it, but the NAIF themselves have said that they're hoping that, that by the end of the year they should have half a dozen or more projects out of the box, and that was before the change they're making. I'm also told that a number of others could be finalised as a result of these changes. So, look, I'm not putting arbitrary timelines on it. The Act itself says that we've established the NAIF for 5 years, so we're a little bit under halfway. At the end of this year, we'll be halfway into that five-year period. So that would probably be a good time to review things again. We'll actually do a legislative review at that halfway stage as well to look more in detail about the legislation. But as I say, while we think things can be going a little quicker, I also want to say the report we've done has shown that has proved that the NAIF has some very good processes. There is a strong pipeline of projects. It's a matter now of converting these into financial close.
Senator Matt Canavan, Minister for Resources in Northern Australia, thanks very much for speaking with us from Kununurra today, and good luck with your deliberations with the other ministers from the Northern Australian state governments.
Thanks very much. Have a great day.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
There you go. It won't happen overnight, says the Minister, but it will happen, those changes announced to the NAIF, the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund, today by the Minister. Now, very soon, I'm going to talk to you about baking a Danish. Now, why would I be talking to you about baking a Danish? Well, because to do it, you need the right mix of ingredients. And apparently, when it comes to the future of the sugar industry, well, it's laid an egg, but it still has a bit of work to do to future-proof itself in an ever-changing environment. It can certainly produce the sugar, we know that, but we're going to hear a little bit more about the eggs and the sugar and the Danishes. I hope I haven't confused you completely, but that's coming up very soon on The Country Hour. But first, a discussion about good and bad neighbours. Is there anything more contentious than neighbourhood disputes? But instead of the annoyance of a yapping dog or someone who doesn't mow their front footpath, imagine if your neighbour's negligence was costing you thousands and thousands of dollars in lost productivity. Now imagine if that neighbour also happens to be the state government. Now, some of you have already jumped in to this discussion on our Queensland Country Hour Facebook page, because we are asking the question of what is your experience with the government meeting its obligations, particularly its biosecurity obligations. Damien from Malanda says that state forests, for example, are feral breeding grounds and the government's done nothing. Shad says that TMR, transport and main roads, are the worst offenders by far. And Wade from Townsville says national parks and the number of wild pigs and horses up there is crazy. Also, if the authorities do implement measures, the public has a meltdown about animal liberation. And Lou from Yeppoon says, and yet they continue to import crops we grow here, and seafood too. Now, we're going to get into that discussion with you in a little while, but something that you might not know is that under Queensland's new or relatively new Biosecurity Act, all landholders are bound by the same obligations when it comes to keeping their land clear of declared pests and weeds. The only catch is that if you're a government department, you can't be prosecuted for breaches of those obligations. So where does that leave you, the neighbour? Well, that's where our Central Queensland rural reporter Amy McCosker takes up the story.
Grazier Jim Elliott is fighting a losing battle against giant rat's tail grass, and he blames the state government.
The
The problem is, and it's not just here, it's in many areas, that the worst transgressor for non-compliance with biosecurity for control of it is the government. And unless somebody is prepared to make the government live up to their responsibilities, the government keeps taking up more and more land, does absolutely nothing to control not just rat's tail, but other weeds and feral animals on their lands, and therefore they are adding to the problems of the productive sector of Queensland.
In Queensland, the state government owns large tracts of land for a variety of uses. For state development areas alone, it owns 188,000 hectares, or over 1,800 square kilometres. Jim Elliott owns a block that shares a fence line with the 27,000-hectare Gladstone State Development Area. He says the state haven't been great neighbours, and he's struggling to keep his weeds under control as a result.
Every year we spend 1,000 man-hours and a lot of chemical. We get everything done. We sit back and think that, righto, we've got everything controlled. Then you get another flood event, another heavy rains. It all comes down the creek, and there we start again. So every year is just a new revisitation of the sins of the government that we, the landowners downstream of them, are expected to control at our own expense. And one plant, one seed head, can have 80,000 seeds on it. So in a square metre, you can be up for 1 million seeds, and their viability of those seeds is very, very high. We're not sure how long they last for. It's at least 10 years. It could be a lot longer than that.
He's not alone in his experiences. Mari Vitelli from AgForce says she hears from plenty of producers with similar concerns.
Often there's a real sense of frustration. We try and get people to resolve it locally where possible.
So does the Queensland government have to meet the same legal obligations when it comes to biosecurity? The 2016 Biosecurity Act aimed to put more responsibility onto individual landholders to ensure they maintain the biosecurity of their property. Malcolm Letts is the Chief Biosecurity Officer, and he explained the application of the legislation in this statement.
All Queenslanders have a responsibility known as the General Biosecurity Obligation to manage biosecurity risks on their land. Local councils are responsible for ensuring the management of listed pests and weeds such as giant rat-tail grass in compliance with the Act. If a complaint relates to land owned or managed by the state, a state department or agency may be given a biosecurity order to rectify the failure to manage a weed. If a complaint relates to land managed by a local government, Biosecurity Queensland can direct the local council to do specific things to manage a biosecurity risk. Although the state is bound by the Act, it cannot be prosecuted for an offence under the Act. Maximum penalties for not complying with a general biosecurity obligation currently range from $63,075 to $378,450, or 3 years in prison depending on the type and severity of the offence.
In the Gladstone area alone, the Act has been used to compel several landowners to undertake biosecurity measures this year already. Chris Irving is the Gladstone Regional Council's Pest Management Coordinator, and he says the system is working.
The powers that are given to local government, we've achieved positive outcomes for land that is owned by a variety of stakeholders. So that's local landholders, that's owned by industry, and that's owned by state and managed by state government as well. We haven't needed to, I guess, go to the pointy end of legislation where it gets to that prosecution point, where I believe that that's probably where some of the untested aspects of that legislation come in. So through our compliance framework and through our engagement with the owners of the properties, we've been able to achieve positive outcomes for matters that have been identified, for compliance matters that have been identified.
But Jim Elliott says it's very hard for councils to oversee the actions of the state. He believes there needs to be a third party running biosecurity compliance.
One of the main problems is the council, who have responsibility for controlling it in the area, have a problem because the government is seen to be the source of their revenue, the people that they have to do business with, and therefore they're very, very lax in trying to take action against the government itself when it is the transgressor. And until we get some sort of independent assessment and independent control of it, I don't think you're going to get anywhere.
That is a pretty frustrated grazier, Jim Elliott, ending that report from Amy McCosker. He makes a pretty compelling case, doesn't he? I'd love to know your view, though, about how an independent biosecurity watchdog effectively could help landholders in the war against declared pests and weeds. You're required, all landholders are required under the Biosecurity Act to make sure that they are dealing with those problems. But what happens when they don't? And what happens when that landholder is a state government department? Now, you can give me a call right now on that, 1300 360 612. That's 1300 360 612. Or you could send me a text on 0487 993 222. Or, as I mentioned, there is some discussion going on Facebook right now about that. Steve from Bowen says he reckons independent oversight should fix the problem. We get the government to prosecute itself and pay the penalties from consolidated revenue. Then the fines can be put into consolidated revenue that might be expensive for taxpayers to administer in a real world where red tape is evil. I'm starting to pick up on your tongue-in-cheek approach there, Steve, but what he is saying is that he thinks that there is probably a more logical and workable solution. Maybe there needs to be a review of the management of Crown land and national parks with regard to pest and noxious plant control, with some input and participation from neighbouring landholders. That's Steve from Bowen on our Queensland Country, our Facebook page. Still plenty of scope for your experiences as well, good or bad. 1300 360 612 if you'd like to give me a call.
Want to make life even better for young people in your community?
We want to inspire young people to take their first step to success.
Talk about mental health.
Celebrate culture.
Break the cycle of domestic violence.
Bring medical professionals and their communities together.
Can your community group implement one of these great ideas? There's $100,000 in grants available to help make it happen. Apply now for a Youth Innovation Grant at abc.net.au/haywire. Closes May 14.
It is 27 minutes past 12. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. My name's Charlie, and it's great to have you along this lunch hour. We will just move along to the next story, but if you'd like to come back to that issue, we still have time to get into it straight after the news and weather. But before we do that, the Horticulture Industries Research and Development Body has just launched a $5 million project to strengthen evidence of pest control measures. It's hoped that by proving a systems approach to pest management, farmers will be able to access new markets for their produce, particularly in Asia. And the CSIRO senior research scientist, Dr. Rix van Klikken, says that the new protocols that will be established by the end of this four-year project will give growers more options, both domestically and internationally.
Well, at the moment, a big barrier to accessing markets is the presence of pests and diseases that the growers might have that the importing countries or states don't have and want to stay free of. So at the moment, it's all about demonstrating either that you don't have the pest, or if you do, you need to apply an endpoint treatment to kill any pest that might be in your fruit. And that endpoint treatment can be pretty damaging and costly. And it also can be a little bit unnecessary if the fruit that you're sending is already clean because of all the things that you're doing on the farm. So this project is about developing a new approach called systems approaches that can allow farmers to access markets by demonstrating that all the things that they're doing on the farm and in the packing house and in storage that might reduce the risk of the pest being in the fruit together means that the fruit is safe to export.
So potentially could this open up new markets, or is it more to shore up the markets we already have?
In some cases it's accessing new markets. It's really case by case. In other cases it's accessing existing markets but doing so more competitively. So for example, some of the endpoint treatments for some fruit really reduces the quality of the fruit and the shelf life of the fruit. So by using systems approaches, it allows them to access the premium markets in existing countries. And that's really where Australia is positioning itself.
You talk about systems approach. Exactly, I mean, what exactly is that?
So systems approaches is a technical term used in trade. And it basically means that you're using two or more measures or activities that reduce the risk, that together reduces the risk of the fruit having the pest when it's sold. And so those measures might include anything from the fruit being a poor host to the pest, or the activities you might be doing on the farm to reduce pest levels down to an acceptable level, or it might include things that you might do in the packing shed, for example, that sorts infested fruit away from uninfested fruit, for example.
Now, this is a $5 million project over 4 years. So what exactly does that get you? What will you be doing over the next 4 years?
So anything in the regulatory space is complicated, a little bit slow, because it requires intergovernmental agreement around new protocols. So the project is really focusing on a number of things. It's focusing on developing the scientific approach behind systems approaches, so doing the science that's needed to demonstrate that the two or more measures that you put in place actually results in the risk of the fruit having pests being acceptably low. The project is also very heavily focused on working with industry and regulators to make sure that what we develop is going to be acceptable for everyone. And we're doing that by, in the case of industry, working with a number of case study industries. So in Western Australia, we're working very closely with the apple industry to develop systems approaches for them to access, ultimately, international markets.
Dr. Rix van Klinken there from the CSIRO, speaking with Tara de Landgraft, talking about that new project, which is a collaboration between Hort Innovation, state government departments of primary industries, and also the CSIRO, which is the organisation he represents. Now, we have had a comment from John from Mount Isa, saying the last thing we need, Charlie, is more red tape. He's responding to our issue of whether or not an independent biosecurity watchdog might help landholders who are having a bit of trouble with their next door neighbour in making them accountable to their biosecurity obligations, particularly when that neighbour happens to be a state government department. John suggests that you just need to get your local member to do their job. If they don't, vote them out at the next election. Well, that probably leads to the next comment, which has come from Colin in Townsville. He says that biosecurity was downgraded by the Newman government, with the department closing in North Queensland and many staff sacked. This is all a spin-off from poor LNP policy. Well, there we go. Well, that's probably a case in point. We know what happened to the Newman government. If you'd like to offer your comment, 1300 360 612 is my talkback number, or 0487 993 222. But before we go any further, it is time to find out what is making news this lunch hour with Jodie Gundas.
Good afternoon, Charlie. This afternoon, US officials have confirmed US President Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has travelled to North Korea and met its leader, Kim Jong-un. Mr. Trump has said he hopes to hold a summit with the North Korean leader at the end of next month or in early June. The matriarch of the Bush political dynasty in the US, Barbara Bush, has died aged 92. She was the wife of the 41st President H.W. Bush and mother of the 43rd President George W. Bush. Police are investigating after a man presented to Gympie Hospital overnight with suspected gunshot wounds. The 31-year-old, who's known to police, has not lodged a complaint. And more news coming up at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much for that, Jodie. And to the weather now, where Jonty Hall is keeping an eye on things for us. Has it started to dry up on the coast, Jonty?
G'day, Charlie. Most of the east coast it has, especially up in the tropics there. We've still got a bit of shower activity coming into the wet tropics there. It's hard to get rid of it altogether at this time of year, but certainly much, much lighter than what we've been experiencing of late up there, and that's likely to be the case as we head through the next few days and into next week as well. Not a great deal of change there. Through the drier tropics and down to the central coast, there's really not too much through there at all. We're looking at fairly fine conditions. We've got the southeasterly flow onto the coast there, but it's a bit drier than further north. So, not enough moisture in the air there to support any significant shower activity. So, fine through that area. Out through the west, it's relatively fine conditions continuing, but we do have a series of upper-level troughs that are going to move eastwards across particularly southern parts of the state in the next few days. And we also have some humidity in the air sort of pushing westwards with time from the coast out into those western parts. So that is going to lead to some more slightly unsettled conditions out through there. It's a pretty marginal sort of day-to-day in terms of getting any showers and storms to develop, pretty similar to yesterday. We did see a couple develop up around the Central Highlands area, and that looks like the case today as well. We'll see one or two storms developing around that Carnarvon Ranges area and a bit further east out towards Rolleston, Springshaw, those kind of areas. But otherwise, staying pretty much fine across the west today and staying fairly warm out in the west as well. Temperatures generally a good 4 or 5 degrees above average over much of western Queensland. That instability increases a little bit tomorrow. We get more moisture pouring into that to the southern parts, the southern inland of Queensland, particularly the Warrego and Maranoa areas. So better chances of seeing showers and storms developing through those areas through tomorrow afternoon, particularly over the southern parts. So we could get some fairly strong storms through places like Cunnamulla eastwards towards St George. So those southern parts of the Warrego and Maranoa. Some decent storm activity out through there tomorrow.
Oh, geez, I hope you're right, Jonty. Now, you talked about those warmer-than-average temperatures. It has been a bit of a focus for the whole of April. Where the hell is winter?
It's nowhere to be seen as yet. I guess we did have some fairly cool overnight temperatures recently, particularly over the more elevated parts of the southeast. But that's, you know, kind of what you'd expect at this time of year, a few of those to start turning up. So we did see some of that, but even those cooler starts are sort of going out of the forecast for the next little while with that more moist air pushing in from the east. So, yeah, no cold weather as such on the horizon at this stage. And, yeah, we'll stay fairly warm relative to average, particularly over western Queensland for the next few days.
Righto. And what about the coastal waters forecast? How are things looking out on the water?
Yeah, pretty straightforward, really. We've got a fairly firm ridge of high pressure along the east coast that's really going to persist right through to the weekend. It will start to weaken late in the week, but we'll still be there. So at the moment, we've got the southeasterlies running at around about 15 knots, really, from Fraser Island northwards up to about Mackay. And then it gets a little bit stronger as you head north of there. So solid 15 to 20 from Mackay up to about Cairns, and then even more, sort of 20 to 25 knot southeasterlies from Cairns northwards along the east coast. And over in the Gulf, becoming fairly light through this afternoon, but tomorrow morning we will see the easterlies picking up probably close to 20 knots for a few hours tomorrow morning before easing back, as it usually does, into the afternoon once again.
Jonty Hall, thanks very much for that comprehensive update.
No worries, Shelley.
Jonty, the senior forecaster with the Bureau of Meteorology. We'll check in with them again same time tomorrow. Now, I have a bit of a riddle for you. Why did the chicken cross the road? Okay, I know that you know the answer to that one, but I bet you can't guess what laying an egg has got to do with the sugar industry. I'm still working it out myself, but I'm going to take you next to Mackay, where all sectors of the sugar industry have come together to contemplate the future of Australia's sixth largest export industry. But before we head to Mackay, a couple of you have sent me a text, 0487 993 222, or the talkback line is 1300 360 612. Sam says that the government is the biggest offender for WANs, that's weeds of national significance. In 2002, the Hinchinbrook Shire had approximately 1,000 hectares of hymenashi. Now it's increased tenfold, says Sam. They won't make it a class declared weed, which is at their cost, because it's at their cost to eradicate it. And they seriously tell us farmers to improve our water quality for the reef. Smacks of double standards, doesn't it? Well, thank you, Sam, for that comment. Another one says that the council in our area has declared war on pests and weeds on all country except their own Crown land. Fancy that. A lot of lantana, boxthorn, fireweed, mother of millions, foxtail and many other nasties have been flown in by birds or blown in by the wind from the government's own Crown land nurseries. The comment has been cut off. It says, a great idea, but all in all, dot, dot, dot. So I'm sorry that I'm not able to finish your comment there, but we get the idea that there is certainly a number of you that are frustrated about the lack of action on declared pests and weeds on government-owned land. NRL.
Links up right to Luke Brooks. Lovely pass on the angle, Benji Marshall. The Bulls played a metre out a little. Then he got it across for Benji Marshall. He steps his way through to get his second. Oh, the old bloke's playing on young legs again. West Tigers, they are brilliant.
ABC Grandstand.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Every game, every weekend.
NRL.
NRL.
Grandstand NRL.
On ABC Radio.
Where it is 20 to 1, you're listening to me, Charlie McKillop, on the Country Hour today. About 70 industry representatives, a packed room full of millers, growers, researchers, have all been gathering in Mackay to talk about the future direction of the sugar industry. And as I've been alluding to quite cryptically already on the show, they've heard some pretty interesting insights from a number of speakers about the fact that they can't afford to put all of their eggs in the one basket. That's my last egg pun. Here's Lara Webster to explain.
We might have laid an egg, but we are yet to turn it into a delicious Danish pastry. That was one of the opening quotes of the Sugar Future Forum held in Mackay this week. Eggs, chicken, sugar, who would have thought they could go together? But if you really delve down into the quote, I guess what it means is that the sugar industry has a product, and it has platforms, it's eggs. But no one's quite figured out how to make the perfect recipe just yet. And that set the scene pretty well for what futurist Paul Higgins had to tell the growers, millers and researchers present. The industry has been looking at new ways to diversify its product, and one big way is through biofuels. However, Mr. Higgins told those in the room that the biofuels revolution wouldn't be forever, and the industry needed to look further afield if it wanted to have a sustainable future.
So we're heading towards the electrification of transport, you know, cars, trucks, boats, a whole range of things. Not going to impact in the short term, but in the medium to longer term is going to have a big impact on fuels and therefore biofuels, which obviously a big part of sugar industry.
So what does this leave for the sugar industry heading into the future? Obviously there is a big focus on biofuels because we're already seeing, I guess, a little bit of a consumer war against sugar with talks of sugar taxes and those sort of things.
Well, I think in the short term, biofuels will still be a viable market.
And when you say short term, how many years are we looking at?
I mean in the 20s. If we go out into the 30s, all of the projections, you know, even the big oil companies are saying that we're heading towards electrification of the transport fleet. And what that means is people charging their cars off their solar panels at home instead of driving using petrol or biofuels. Once that happens, demand will start to fall quite rapidly. And I don't think the sugar industry wants to be in a rapidly falling market and dependent on a rapidly falling market.
Paul Higgins speaking there. MSF Sugar's General Manager of Business Development, Hal Cook, says MSF's mills are already making ground on their transformations, looking past biofuels. They're even building a power station where the fibre from cane is converted to electricity.
The sugar cane industry has really been fixated on just making sugar. In the future, we really need to get value out of all the parts of the sugarcane plants. So it's about making energy and about making fibres and making other products. So what we need to be thinking about is how do we make protein supplements? How do we make different types of fibres and, you know, different types of plastics? So the ethanol is one of the chemicals you need to make on the journey to where we need to get to. So in 30 years' time, we're not going to be producing ethanol, but we're going to be making biodegradable plastics and fibres that we can use every day.
Hal Cook speaking there. Managing Director of FutureEye, Catherine Tay-White, was another speaker who says the industry needs to put more research into its consumers and social licence, not just areas like cane varieties and productivity. It's a particularly timely point with the sugar sector under fire from some health professionals and advocacy groups who want to see a sugar tax, which they say will help curb obesity.
So if you look at how the industry focuses at research at the moment, it's mostly about plant growth. We're proposing that it starts to focus on sugar in terms of health and to do research collectively with people who really think they've got concerns about the impact of sugar on health, and to use the research opportunity to work together to identify whether there are particular, is it the use of sugar, is it some aspect that you can address inside sugar, etc. So there's a range of things that I'll be putting forward around the research model that would represent quite a big shift.
Catherine Tay-White. Mackay Region grower Joe Muscat was also listening to everything that was said, and I took a moment to ask him what he thought about the future.
There's no doubt the plant that we produce has got a whole range of diversity. And, you know, food, energy and fibre are the three components that plant can be utilised for. So, you know, the way forward is to be able to add value in each one of those areas. I've got no doubt sugar will be used as a food into the future, but it's not going to be the only thing it's going to be used for. And if it is, we really won't be able to be sustainable. Like, you know, the consumer is sort of pointing towards lower consumption levels, and that's, you know, we've got to take those messages on board. We've got to address that.
Mackay Region cane grower Joe Muscat ending that report from Lara Webster, delving into the challenges facing the Australian sugar industry. And that annual conference of cane technologists continues in Mackay today. So keep an ear out to your local rural reports at 6:15 tomorrow for more from that important meeting.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
As emerged yesterday, after more than 1 year of uncertainty over potential gas development in the Northern Territory, the government there's lifted its moratorium on fracking. It comes 15 months after the Labor government introduced that ban while an independent scientific inquiry was conducted. So what are the implications on this side of the border? Well, Eric Barker has the story.
It was a key election promise for the Northern Territory government to ban fracking and conduct an independent scientific inquiry. But yesterday, the Territory's Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, announced the moratorium will be lifted with strict conditions.
After careful consideration of the final report of the independent inquiry, the government has decided to accept all 135 recommendations. We have accepted the key finding of the report, that if all the recommendations are implemented, the risks from fracking can be reduced to acceptable levels. The moratorium on fracking in Northern Territory will be lifted, with strict new laws to be in place before exploration or production can occur.
So what does this mean for the eastern states? Well, according to the Federal Resources Minister Matt Canavan, it will mean a more reliable energy supply.
If this is developed, it'll mean more jobs for the Territory, could mean lower power prices as well and help drive other industries like manufacturing, and it will help our national security because it will underpin our gas security and possibly our oil security as well. All of these things are great things, not just for the Northern Territory, but for our whole country. So this is belated good news today, and let's just get on with the job now.
However, there has been some resistance from the public in the Northern Territory. But Joseph O'Brien, who's the developer behind a proposed Mount Isa to Townsville transmission line, says the bad perception of gas mining is something the industry will need to be patient with. He says the lifting of the moratorium is a positive for Queensland.
At a high level, it's very positive news for the Northern Territory, for the Northwest Minerals Province, and for Queensland and probably Eastern Australia's gas supplies. I think the removal of a moratorium should increase the supply of gas. I expect there is a lot of detail about just how attractive it will be and practical it will be to explore for and extract that gas, but it's a step in the right direction at the very least.
A lot of the reason why the moratorium came up was because of a big resistance against fracking in general from the general public. What does that general resistance do against the gas mining sector?
Look, it's a challenging issue. It's a sort of a social media issue, a perception issue, a fly-in, fly-out protester issue, but one that we just need to continue to be patient on and improve our society's ability to manage, because it is not going to get any less complex, in my opinion.
Joseph O'Brien there talking to Eric Barker.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, I know many country parents have maybe tearfully, maybe they've tried to be brave and not shed any tears as they send their children back to boarding school this week. But they do that because they want to broaden their children's horizons. But there is an unexpected byproduct also that comes from the reciprocal arrangement when city dwellers, the kids that the youngsters are going to school with in boarding school, come back to the bush to experience life out there. And so it has been for the Bowden girls from Barratria Station, northwest of Longreach, who have continued a long-standing tradition of bringing their city mates home with them for the Easter break. Melanie Groves has the story.
For many outback kids who go to boarding school, bringing friends home for a taste of life in the bush is a rite of passage. 17-year-old Lucy Mulligan, a Brisbane girl who goes to Stewart Home and spent Easter on Barratria Station, had no idea what to expect when a friend from the country invited her home for the holidays.
I think it's amazing. It's a completely different lifestyle. You don't really know it unless you're like born into it, I guess. But yeah, it's really interesting day-to-day life compared to a city. Like, you can't just casually go out to the cinemas or whatever. It's really cool. We've driven the manual and the motorbike. That was really fun. And we went for a swim in the dam, and we went and saw the gorge yesterday, which was really amazing, just a lot of flies. we did some branding and some like immunizing the cattle the other day, and that was a really interesting experience. I've never really done anything like that, obviously. Yeah.
For many kids from the outback, moving to the coast or bigger centres at some point is part of life. But many of those who grew up in cities, like Lucy Mulligan, would never have contemplated a life in the bush.
It'd be really hard to just go into from a city lifestyle. I think I'm just so used to just having a lot of opportunities around me to do all different stuff, but like here it's very specific lifestyle, so I think it is something that you would need to sort of be born into, I guess. But I mean, I would be open to spending a while out here, but probably not a whole future.
But life can turn in unexpected directions. Just over the road from Barratria is Kelly's Creek, home to Kim and Peter Saunders. Kim grew up in Hawaii before being sent to Australia for boarding at Stewart Home School in the 1970s. Like many who went before her, she spent a holiday break at her friend Michelle Saunders' property near Longreach.
Michelle had an older brother who was just lovely, but he was that older brother, and we were little kids, really. I was 14 at that stage, but gee, I think I fell in love that trip even with this with what is now, who is now my husband, Peter. But he said I was just you were just a young a brat, probably would describe it.
For Kim, while Longreach was so very different to Hawaii, it's been home now for many years, and it's a home she wouldn't have had if it weren't for that boarding school holiday in the bush. So will the visitors to Barratria this holiday return to the bush? Who can know what the future may hold, but these girls have at least had a taste of what the country has to offer.
I think having the boarding schools, that really, like growing up in a boarding school, that really helps you get an idea and what else is there. So it's like, it breaks down that sort of barrier, and it's really, I think it's a really good thing to be able to break that down before you go out into the world.
Lucy Mulligan back at school in Stewart Home in Brisbane this week after her break in Western Queensland. All the better for her experience, no doubt, even coming to terms with those bloody flies. And aren't they still thick on the ground out there? Well, that might lead to our next story, where we're watching out for the new buzzword in agriculture. It's insectariums. In the next step in integrated pest management, IPM, farmers are now establishing insect-friendly habitats on their farms in a bid to attract and breed up beneficial insects. This report by Sally Dacus.
So the concept of an insectarium is about planting local native vegetation that's going to attract beneficial insects to help with the production on your farm, and it's using local native vegetation that's got a high nectar source.
Victorian Landcare facilitator Karen Thomas has been working with farmers in the Yarra Valley and the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria.
So it's about planting flowering vegetation that's going to bring the beneficial insects in and provide them with the nectar and the pollen that they need to be able to lay lots of eggs and live locally to your production areas during those high pest pressure months. So it's really critical to try and have flowering native vegetation, say, in September. That's going to bring in things like your hoverflies, which will usually emerge around October and carry through into the summer months. Hoverfly adults, particularly the females, need that pollen and nectar source before they can go and lay their eggs next to an aphid population. And it's actually their larval stage that's predatory. So it's their larval stages that are eating the aphids. The adults require the nectar. So you need to have both of those things in the orchard to be able to have that particular beneficial insect. And it's similar for parasitic wasps. They require a nectar source. Brown lacewings, they like to lay their eggs in native grasses. There's been a lot of research done by Mary Ritalik in South Australia to show that. And so you need to have all of these different types of native vegetation to be able to provide the habitat and the nectar for these native insects that you're trying to attract.
Hort Innovation is investing grower levies in a national research program at Charles Sturt University on the value of beneficial insects.
People have been attempting to manage pests since biblical times and no doubt even before then. But one of the kind of fundamental approaches that I think is generally underused in modern agricultural systems is to try and make better use of natural enemies of pests. So these are things like predators and parasitic wasps that if we let them flourish, potentially can keep pests in check and avoid them reaching such high densities that we need to reach for the spray boom.
Professor of Applied Ecology Jeff Gurr at Charles Sturt. The research will look at what the beneficial insects need and how farmers can integrate that into their farming systems.
The key thing to keep in mind with enhancing these natural enemies is that they have requirements for certain things other than just the pests. So an obvious example is shelter, and unless they have areas in which they can shelter, then the density of these goodies in the landscape can decline. Similarly, many of them require very particular additional foods like nectar or in some cases pollen. And if, again, within the landscape, there are few sources of nectar and pollen, this can have a really devastating effect on their local density. So in this project, we're going to work with farmers and try and find ways that we can ensure such resources are available in the landscape, but in ways that are compatible with mainstream modern farming practices. So the farm can still make a buck. There's no need for the grower to radically change their way of business. But we've just tweaked the landscape a little bit so that appropriate forms of vegetation are present that can provide things like shelter and nectar and pollen.
That's why you need to be aware of this new buzzword, insectariums, which was being explained there by Professor Jeff Kerr at Charles Sturt University. Now let's find out what's being paid for what class of cattle. Numbers down at Dalby today, and here's Trevor Hess with more.
Good afternoon, Charlie. Numbers reduced by 39% to 4,880 at Dalby today. Buyer attendance was generally good and most were operating in a cheaper market. Medium weight yearling steers to feed averaged 11 cents less. However, heavyweight yearling steers over 400 kilos to feed lost 3 to 5. Yearling heifers experienced the largest losses to average 11 to 20 cents less. Heavy grown steers and bullocks sold to a cheaper trend to lose 6 to 9 cents. And a good supply of cows fell in price a further 2 to 6 cents against the large losses experienced the previous week. Medium weight yearling steers to feed averaged 277 and made to 283. Heavyweight yearling steers to feed averaged 282 and made to 286.2. Medium weight yearling heifers to feed averaged 253 and made to 266. Heavy grown steers to export slaughter averaged 263 and bullocks made to 268 to average 267. Medium weight two score cows average 172 and good heavy cows made to 216.2, most around 207. This has been Trevor Hess from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
To Charters Towers now, where more than 2,600 head of cattle have been yarded at the Dalrymple sale yards. Andrew Painter's there.
Good afternoon, Charlie. Cattle comprise of a larger number of processor cattle, especially the female section. Steers had competition from both the meatworks and export buyers. Yarding was gone from Georgetown, Garoo, Western Coastal and local areas. Bullocks were quoted back 24 cents. Heifers were 29 cents easier. Cows were 22 cents easier and bulls were 20 cents dearer from last week's rates. The bullocks in over 500 kilos made to 252.2 to average 232. The cows over 400 kilos made to 202.2 cents to average 173.6. Bullocks, top pen of bullocks was 14 sold on behalf of MJ and HJ Breden, returned 52.2 cents, weighed 578 kilos to return 1,459 per head. Best cows on behalf of JC Ross, sold for 202 cents, weighed 508 kilos and returned 1,028. store sale still in progress. That's it from Charters House. Thank you.
Good on you, Andrew. And that's it from me at the Queensland Country Hour today. The last word from Monica on the text line. She says that that insect thingy is just the reality of permaculture practices. Thanks for yet another great show. Thanks for listening, Monica. I'll be back with you tomorrow.